Welcome back, baseball amigos, to the latest episode of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available exclusively via the Nats GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. The Nats GM Show is sponsored by No Halftime and the No Halftime app. Please go to NoHalftime.com for more information. Now, to our special guest.
Hey, this is Ben Lindbergh, author of the best-selling book, The Only Rule Is It Has to Work, and you are listening to The Nats GM Show.
Are proud to welcome Pitch FX guru at Baseball Prospectus and Pitch Info, and friend of mine and friend of the podcast, we've got Dan Rosanson. Dan, welcome back to the Nats GM Show.
It's good to be back. Yeah, I see you pretty much every year these days at Sabre Seminar in Boston, and then, yeah, I get to come on the show every once in a while, so it's good to be back.
Yeah, it was really nice getting to spend some time with you at up in Boston at Sabre Seminar this year. What a wonderful event, first and foremost.
Yeah, I mean, it's really wonderful to see how much it's grown. You see that it's making inroads into, you know, what you would consider maybe the non-traditional audiences for analytics, but it's really, it's integrating itself as being part of just sort of the anyone who's interested in seeing where baseball is going these days.
It's, you know, and even above that, it's a great time to see some people you talk to every day on Twitter, but you don't get to see necessarily except for once or twice a year, like yourself, frankly.
Yeah, no, there are a bunch of Nets fans who I run into there who, yeah, even though we live in the same city pretty much, we run into each other in Boston. But yeah, it's definitely a good time. You get to put the faces to the Twitter handles.
Well, I wanted to do a little bit of a Nationals recap of the NLDS series against the Dodgers, and the first person who came to mind was you, just somebody to lament, vent, and kind of everything in between about the five-game series that we just unfortunately lost just a few days ago.
Well, it's kind of funny how I've been dealing pretty well with it, I would say, because I kind of started going through my mourning process once they were down 4-1 in game 5. So I just kind of got a lot of my negativity out in that, you know, inning or so before they put a couple runs back on the board. And now I'm just sort of trying to approach it from a healthy mourning perspective. I mean, what have your sort of emotions been like, your emotional roller coaster?
I was like you, actually. As soon as Jacques Peterson hit the home run and was it the sixth? I guess it was the sixth. I thought that we were going to lose. As soon as it went to 1-1, I thought the game was over, honestly. And some of that's just the utter pessimism I have in DC sports in general. But as I kind of said to you off air a little bit, I really did not think and don't think that the Nationals could beat the Cubs in a 7-game series. So particularly with how they were going to have to expend energy and their pitching staff and so forth in game 5 to win that game if they did. So I think that makes it feel a little bit more palatable, or at least not quite as much mourning.
Yeah, I mean, we knew we were up against, at the very least, the Dodgers, who are a very tough team, and then, in all likelihood, it would be the Cubs. And we knew that we were going to do it without Strasburg and without Ramos. So, you know, in an ideal environment where everybody's healthy and playing 100%, you could see that being a really competitive series, but especially without having a couple of key guys there, I think it would be, yeah, very optimistic to go against a Cubs team that has all the pieces that they need, and they're playing well and they're energized. So hopefully it'll make for good watching them the rest of the way.
And the truth of the matter is, now that I even think about it, I started even the mourning process when Strasburg went down and with Ramos going down, because those were really, in some ways, the two places that you could not lose somebody. I mean, the drop-off from what Ramos was doing to the combination of Severino and Lobaton is just massive, and the drop from Strasburg to, I guess, Joe Ross in a game 3 or 4 in a series is just, it's just such a dramatic difference. And with the Dodgers being, you know, pretty comparable to the Nats, I honestly, I didn't think they could get through the series.
Yeah, well, I was optimistic about Joe Ross being able to come in, and you know, I was reminded of 2012 when Ross Detweiler had to fill in for Strasburg, and he did well. He pitched six innings, I think, one unearned run. But Ross clearly, I mean, he was nervous. It was his first postseason game. Wasn't able to rise to that challenge, and so yeah, I think it certainly would have helped to have a healthy Steven Strasburg in that series. Just a shame.
And let me ask you, do you think Ross is healthy? Because I'm going to use you as kind of your pitch FX guru-dom here and start there, but I never saw him. I'm not sure he's fully healthy. I mean, the fastball command wasn't there. It seemed like some of his breaking pitches weren't breaking quite as sharply. Did you see anything in Joe Ross once he came back?
Well, to be honest, unfortunately, I couldn't catch the first couple of innings of the game he pitched in the division series, and that was really all he had time to pitch. My sense is that, I mean, the thing is, when guys come back from injury, when pitchers come back from injury, the velocity is not the thing that you worry about. It's getting that timing down and, you know, having the feel for your pitches. I mean, by now, whatever could have been ailing him, he'll certainly have time to recover. I think it probably has more to do with the fact that he was against just a really tough lineup that he didn't face a lot because, you know, they don't face each other very often. And it was his first moment on that biggest stage. And sometimes just the adrenaline can throw you off that much that you don't have the sharpness that you want. I mean, it even happened to Scherzer in game one, I think.
That's true. That's actually a really good point. That's a good point.
He's the kind of guy who gets so amped up that sometimes you just have to, like, tell him to take a deep breath and channel that energy into making a better pitch than just, you know, throwing the hell out of it.
Well, and Ross struggles a little bit against left-handed hitting as well, and the Dodgers have quite a lineup of left-handed hitters too. So, I mean, it wasn't the perfect matchup for him going in as well. That's a good point.
Yeah, no, the lefties in that lineup, yeah, they killed us.
So I guess the first question I want to ask, or the first place I want to start, is just what are the takeaways from the series? I mean, what can we learn? How do the Nationals get better next year? And, you know, why did they lose?
Well, I think it kind of tells you the story of the season in that they were a really good team and they just were missing a couple little things that could have put them over the top. I think one of the big sort of gaping holes that was exposed and very painfully by Trey Turner having to track that ball down in game five, the Justin Turner double, is the Nationals need a good center fielder, and they didn't have that this year. For me, I think getting Ben Revere to rediscover his swing is something that really, you know, that's one ninth of the lineup that would return to normal production, and it would allow somebody like Turner to play his natural position. That's really the way I think things could improve from there. I think, you know, having the drop off from Denard Span to the way Revere played this year, where he was essentially supposed to be another Span, that's something that it really sapped the Nats of having some lineup stability, and then threw the defense into kind of people having to play out of position.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I mean, I think Trey did an admirable job, frankly, playing center field, something I don't think he had ever really played in his career, and then just shifting over for a week in the minors and then playing it in the majors. I thought he did a good job, but like you say, I mean, there were certainly, I don't know, I could think of three or four examples, you know, during the summer that, you know, he was exposed as a non, you know, traditional center fielder.
Right. That's the thing is he put everything he had into it, and he has the speed where he can create range, but there's a certain familiarity. And I mean, we saw it with Bryce early in his career where he was still coming into his own as an outfielder. I think, you know, it's kind of funny how Danny Espinosa ended up essentially being the regular shortstop after all of this because of that shift. But I think Turner's supposed to be a shortstop. And that's the bottom line. And if the Nats want to have a sort of a solid set piece defense, they're going to need somebody who's a natural outfielder playing out there.
Yeah. Another takeaway, and I'd love to get your take on my thought of this, is I think that the Dodgers' depth, both in the bullpen and certainly on their bench, really exposed kind of some of the weaknesses the Nationals had. I mean, you mentioned Revere having such a tough year, but it was, you know, Michael A. Taylor, you know, striking out a couple times in big situations, and I think he might have a busted thumb. You know, Defoe striking out in that key situation. You know, and then you look across the aisle, and it's, you know, the Dodgers have Yasiel Puig and Howie Kendrick and Andre Ethier and Carlos Ruiz on their bench. I mean, four guys that could certainly start for most teams. I think that was one area where the Nationals really got exposed as well.
That's true. The Nats definitely could have done with a better bench. Part of that had to do with the fact that they were, I mean, that Ramos was, they were already pressing one of their reserves into being the catcher. But also the Dodgers just kind of got lucky. They discovered that, hey, this Andrew Tolles guy can hit even better than Puig.
That's a good point.
And so then Puig was able to become this, like, kind of super bench player where you could use him not just to hit, but also he would be a dangerous arm in the outfield too, like a, you know, a true fourth outfielder type. It's something that definitely they'll have to look in the offseason. I mean, I was hoping we would see more, a little more hitting maturity out of Taylor this year, but I just don't think he has the plate discipline, the pitch recognition to kind of play that hit tool up enough to make the kind of presence at the plate where, I mean, you're right. I think for a pinch hitter like Taylor, somebody who hasn't even swung the bat in the game, a relief pitcher can just sort of think, all right, I can tempt him with the high fastball. He's not going to be loose enough to catch up with it. And so it's not really a good use of his skill if he's in that position.
Oh, I totally agree. I want to get your thoughts on the kind of managerial, I don't know if head-to-head or the chess match that they played, just your thoughts. But obviously I think Dave Roberts did a terrific job in Game 5, but I think I said it somewhere else if I didn't say it on a podcast, but I think that just because Dave Roberts did a great job playing, you know, the matchups, doesn't mean that Dusty did a poor job on the other end of managing the series.
Yeah, I mean, I would urge people to read Dave Cameron's piece on FanGraphs from, I think, yesterday or the day before, which is called Don't Blame Dusty for This One. Because I think it's, I mean, people weren't even talking about Baker as a factor, really, until kind of things fell apart and, you know, people search for scapegoats. I thought he did a perfectly adequate job with managing the series. It wasn't the kind of, you know, because obviously he's sort of old school, but he wasn't by the books. He knew that he needed to bring in high leverage relievers earlier than you would normally. You didn't have that thing with Williams saying, well, that's our seventh inning guy and that's our eighth inning guy. And just the way the players talk about him tells you that they clearly buy into what he's doing, and that's obviously the most important thing. Is manager is the guy who tells you how you're going to play, and so you need players to buy in. And when guys like Jason Worth, the clubhouse veterans, say this guy did a terrific job, that's a really big departure from what Worth said at the end of the 2014 season, which was, well, you know, we were a really good team, and so the manager sort of didn't have to do a lot to get us to where we were. So that's sort of my takeaway from it, is I thought, yeah, Roberts, he got very aggressive with the bullpen use, and I think the fact that Dusty was not quite as aggressive is not necessarily a mark against him. I think he felt comfortable with the moves he was making, and in retrospect, a lot of the stuff is really not his fault, certainly not Bob Henley sending Worth.
Yeah, I mean, I would if we're looking to blame somebody, I would blame that much more than, you know, Dusty's bullpen usage. I mean, there were one or two examples where I thought he waited too long with a reliever, but for the most part, that's also just revisionist history that, you know, you see that through a 2020 lens. But, I mean, I thought he pulled Scherzer at the right time, frankly. I mean, you could have let him go a little longer, but I think he was at 99 pitches in Game 5, and
And he had thrown a lot of tough pitches. Like, that was a hard 99.
And Justin Turner's at-bat in the third or fourth inning, where it was a 13 or 14-pitch at-bat, was a very, very big turning point in the game that nobody really will talk about or point to.
No, I think that's true. Because you're right. Scherzer had had, like, some really short innings to that point. He had, like, a 7-pitch second or something like that.
And he had a chance to get through the fourth with about 45 to 50 pitches. And then the next thing you knew, he got through the fourth with about 65 or 70, if my memory serves me.
That sounds about right.
And that's a huge difference, obviously, because then, you know, you assume he probably could have gotten through the seventh if he doesn't have such a labor-intensive at-bat or sequence at bat against Turner. So just, you know, one of those things you don't think about. So
yeah, and the Nats had good options to go to in the pen, like, and Sean, you know, who'd been more reliable than Sean Kelly this year,
right? But the truth is, another guy that really gets overlooked is how good of a job Kelly's done this season. I mean, you know, what a great job.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's a strikeout machine. And in the late innings, that's what you want. Guy who's not even going to give the other team a chance to get the bat on the ball. It's just, you know, he happened to, he had this weird thing where he lost the feeling in his fingers after he threw the pitch to Turner. So God knows what that was about. But
I've heard him say he thinks he's going to be okay, but I'm not sure I've ever heard an athlete say that they didn't think they were going to be okay either. So.
Right. I mean, supposedly, you know, he's saying the elbow is fine, and obviously with a guy who's had two Tommy John surgeries, that's the first thing you think about, and there was the question of whether, you know, Dusty made him warm up too quickly. But I guess if you're going to blame Dusty for warming a guy up too quickly, you can't also say he was too slow in trying to go to his best relievers.
Yeah, then you're just playing totally, you know, hindsight is 20/20. You can't blame them for everything as well, so.
Right.
So how do you, I guess, if we want to ask one more question, just kind of bottom lining the NLDS and the season in general, kind of your overall recap thoughts and so forth?
Well, what I liked people saying on Twitter, across the Twitterverse, was for the people who weren't interested in the outcome, is they really enjoyed watching. It was a good series. They were, you know, game 3 was 8-3, but, you know, half of those runs came in the ninth inning.
Sure.
It was a really close series. You had managers that had to make tough decisions. You had Clayton Kershaw at, you know, struggling, but then having his little moment of redemption at the end. You got to see Trey Turner on a national stage perform well. So, you know, that's also part of the what makes the healing process better is, you know, at least we got to see some good baseball.
Yeah, I think I'd like to build off that point a little bit if I could. And I think the Nationals won, what, 94 games, 95 games this season? I mean, what a great season.
Yeah.
Ran away with the division. I mean, you can't ask for any more than that. You know, they went up against a Dodgers team that really matched up well with them. Unfortunately, the Nationals had a couple of key injuries at the end of the season. I mean, we've already mentioned Ramos and Strasburg. I think, you know, Murphy wasn't playing at 100%, and I think we'll find out sooner or later that Bryce Harper wasn't as well. So I think taking a very good Dodgers team to 5 games in that lens is impressive. I think at the other end of it, you know, you do need to finally get out of that first round. And I think this year, you know, they had several opportunities to win that game, and it's, you know, it's tough and it's what have you in that retrospect. But I think you kind of look at this season as they ended up about where they should have, considering the roster they had at the end of the year and, you know, the talent they have.
Yeah, I think that's about right. I think if there was a team that felt like they fell short, maybe it was the 2012 season. But
that one stings to me much more than any other year for me, by far. What about for you, the same?
Yeah, I'd have to think so. Although, I mean, 2014 also, I mean, I was at the last game of the season in 2014 when Jordan Zimmermann threw his no-hitter. And so that kind of had this feeling of, wow, this team's really going to do something. They stumbled a little bit more this year because of the injuries, or at least it felt like they were stumbling more, I think, even though they did play some good baseball at the end. It also, you know, there isn't as much of a question in the off season of, like, is half the team going to even be coming back? I mean, last year there was so many tough decisions to make. The year before, too, there were a number. And this year it's, looking at the big free agent questions, it's mostly Melanson and Ramos, I would guess.
Yeah, and actually, you gave me a perfect segue because that was the next topic that I wanted to get to, is talk to you a little bit about the upcoming offseason. So let's start with the offense. I think the two big questions you've already kind of put on the table a little bit. What are they going to do at catcher? I think Wilson Ramos is going to be hurt until certainly opening day, I think, is a fair assumption, and he's a free agent. And what are they going to do in center field / shortstop / Trey Turner? So I'd love to just kind of give you the ball and start there.
Yeah. Ramos, I was reading, they're saying the rehab will take about 6 to 8 months, which I guess is pretty standard for an ACL. I think it would be, it seems like, you know, they got a good look at Severino at the end of the year and hit better than he had pretty much throughout the minors, which was a very pleasant surprise.
I thought Severino looked a lot better than I've seen him in the minors. Much better.
Definitely. I mean, his profile coming up through the minors was like, if the hit tool plays up, then he can be the defense first backup. Like, and he would have to hit better just to fit that role. But it seems like he almost can become a little bit more of the I think he's moved pretty clearly into that role now, where he's not going to be a liability if he's your second catcher. The full
platoon
footwork is always
second catcher. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the footwork has always been there. He knows how to gun guys down on the bases. His pitch framing has improved. Obviously, that's a skill every catcher needs these days. So it's been, I would say, a good year for him. He's probably improved his stock quite a bit in terms of competing for a 25-man roster spot.
I was really impressed with the way he seemed to handle the pitching staff and handle himself. He seemed to have a real kind of quiet confidence for a 23-year-old pressed into this situation. I was really impressed with his presence, I guess is maybe the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, I mean, he was sort of a slow burn in the minors. He had to make a number of stops along the way, but that gave him a chance to adjust in a number of new environments, learn new pitchers. And so, yeah, you're right. He definitely seems mature. He seemed like he was comfortable in that role.
What are you thinking about? Do they let Lobatone go and have Severino be the backup guy and go find a free agent? Is that what they do?
I think they can do that. I mean, they do have other catchers in the minors who are on the development path, guys like Jackson Reitz, although I don't think his bat played up this year the way...
It was better this year than it was his first year, for sure. But he's got a couple of years for... You know, he's a long ways.
Yeah, Reitz is more the kind of higher ceiling, but he's a younger. There's another one I'm trying to think.
Keyboom.
Right, Spencer Keyboom. And he came up like right at the very end of the year, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. He got a real, a legitimate cup of coffee.
Yeah, I mean, so I didn't follow Keyboom much this year. What's your sense of what you think he could compete for next year?
I think he is going to be at AAA, kind of they're grooming him if somebody gets hurt for a long term while he comes up as the backup. But if somebody gets hurt for 10 days, they'll have a 30-year-old journeyman type guy, you know, a Jonathan Solano type at AAA that they would bring up. I think he needs one more year.
Yeah.
And I think he's got a very similar profile to Pedro Severino. I think Keyboom's got a little bit more pop, but I think Severino is probably very comparable players.
Right. Now, the question that this raises is then what to do about your opening day catcher next year? Because, Ramos probably becomes available again in, like, June or something. And it's tempting to say, well, you can start Severino for that period and hope he beats expectations the way he did again this year, but that's a risky thing.
And that's even assuming that you want to re-sign Ramos, which I think is a real question. I mean, this is a 30-year-old catcher now with a second ACL injury in his right knee. You know, he's had one fantastic offensive year. He's had 2 years where he stayed healthy until the end of this year. I mean, I don't know. That contract feels like it could be set up to be a bust.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to think of a ready comparison in terms of contracts, because you're thinking either with free agent contracts for catchers, you've got your kind of Brian McCann, top of the line, 5 years, $70 million type. But last year I was looking at the free agent catcher signings, and they were, you know, mostly one year with a team option, minor league. I mean, it's kind of hard, but there's actually going to be a number of free agent catchers available this year. Matt Wieters, Chris Iannetta, AJ Ellis, Luke Roy. So there's
Castro,
a lot of ways to go.
Hundley. Yeah, they're now it's going to be a little bit of just, you know, hopping around. One guy goes from this team to another, but I agree with you. There are a fair amount of guys out there.
Yeah. So I think if I was a GM and was really aggressively interested in Wilson Ramos for whatever reason, I think you could maybe look in the, you know, 2 or 3 years, and you'd have to pick a dollar figure that was kind of intermediate to what, you know, the top of the line guys are getting, and then also the cheap replacement guys. So I don't know, $8-9 million a year. I mean, I'm just ballparking it.
I think you might be right. Particularly, I think you got to get a discount on next season, 2017, if you're going to sign him for 2 or 3 years. Maybe you get him for $6 million next year, and then, you know, 12-12, or, you know, I'm just throwing out numbers, but something along those lines.
Right. Because one of the things Ramos has is, with even besides his physical presence on the field, is he knows how to handle the pitchers. And that's it's a really valuable thing to have, and it's arguably the most important thing a catcher can do. So that's one of the reasons why it would really hurt to lose him. I understand if Rizzo says, hey, you know, we gave him a great run, but he's still going to be a lot of money, even with that discount, and we have some guys in-house we might want to turn to, or a veteran who could fill in the meantime. But it would hurt to lose that institutional memory, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I find what they're going to do with that situation really interesting this offseason. So let me get your take on shortstop center field, because I think if they just wanted to go status quo, they could keep Espinoza for one more year, put Turner in center field, and then maybe the plan is in 2018, maybe Robles is your center fielder and Turner moves back to shortstop. But that's, you know, making a lot of assumptions. What are you thinking, you know, at both those spots?
Well, I kind of mentioned it earlier. I feel like it hangs on Ben Revere. You know, this is really the one year he hasn't hit well. The problem is, if he doesn't hit well, there's nothing else in his offensive profile that really helps, because even the speed doesn't work if you're not on base. So I think in the ideal world, whatever it was that was nagging him, and I mean, he had, aside from Ryan Howard, the lowest batting average on balls in play in baseball this year. Figure out how to get him back into his old profile. If that doesn't work, I guess this year is what they ended up doing this year becomes very tempting, where you have Espinoza at short and Turner in center, and clearly more reps in center will help Turner sort of ease into being a center fielder. But that's really not what they should be shooting for. I like Espinoza as an infield bench option. The bat concerns become less of an issue if he's a defensive replacement. And, you know, you can stick him at second base. You know,
let me interrupt you here, because I'm really fascinated. So I had almost given up on the idea of Revere coming back, as I think his arbitration number is going to be $6-7 million, which isn't huge in baseball numbers, but it's still pretty healthy. And when he didn't even make the postseason roster, I thought that was kind of the sayonara to him. So you think he's going to come back next year?
I mean, I doubt it, but I think it would be worth entertaining if they think they know what happens. I mean, because there aren't a lot of really good center field options in the free agent market.
That's a very good point. Unless you want to pay up for Cespedes, who is not a center fielder, you know, even as I'm saying that. Yeah, that's a good point.
I guess part of it is, right, how rigid do you want to be with positions? There isn't anybody on the team right now who's a natural center fielder. There isn't anybody in the minors. You know, Victor Robles in 3 years will be a natural center fielder in the majors. But I guess, so do you think they're going to go the Turner-Espinosa route again?
I do, because I think that they're going to have such a difficult time filling the catcher vacancy, and I think that's more pressing. Because I don't think they have their guy on the roster. I think you could argue that for one more year you could do Espinosa, maybe try to get another Steven Drew or somebody, a nice backup to try to not give him 155 games played. But I think they're going to try to find that center fielder, but I think that they're going to find that the upgrade is just – it's going to be too difficult to do.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the question at that point is – how much room Turner has left to become a more natural outfielder.
And also, where are they taking the payroll? I mean, I think that's a fair question as well. I mean, they brought it back to about $147 million this year. It was about $160 the year prior. You know, if you're going to go get that center fielder, you know, you could start making this team expensive if you really go spend some money as well. I mean, you know, just their starting rotation is going to cost them $60 million next year.
Yeah, well, they... like you say, they'd have to be getting a corner outfielder and then moving somebody over to get really three quality outfielders, and obviously that would become pretty expensive. I would say catcher, I would agree with you, is the bigger priority because of all the things, like I said, the sort of, you know, managing the staff and holding the fort together on the field. The payroll question is interesting because it was, I mean, obviously this is an ownership that wants to win. And thing is, they're clearly really close to getting onto that, that sort of magic point where they can handle any team that comes their way, but they're not quite there yet. And the good thing about it is they still have another couple of years where that core of the team is still going to be here. And they showed they were willing to dig deep and give Strasburg 7 years at a prime pitcher's rate.
So let me use that once again as a transition, and let's maybe we'll flip around to talk pitching next season. I think the starting rotation feels pretty squared away if, you know, you assume Strasburg comes back to some, you know, to his health. I'm assuming they're going to pick up Gio's option. I don't know why they wouldn't at $12 million in this market. I think that's a pretty fair, you know, price for him one more year. And then, you know, you probably have Joe Ross and maybe Ronaldo Lopez battle it out for the fifth spot.
Yeah, I mean, I feel kind of stupid now because in the annual for this year, the BP annual, I said it would be a fool's bet for to say Tanner Roark would have a 30-start season. That ended up being that was my bad, because I was thinking that Giolito was going to end up making a much bigger splash than he did.
And there's a name we need to talk about is Lucas Giolito.
Yeah, that was probably one of the, I guess you would say, disappointments for this season. Obviously, we're not going to call him a disappointment as a prospect, but for this year, we were definitely expecting a lot more, I think. He'd already spent some time in AAA, and it seemed like a more natural transition by the middle of this year to fill into that role.
And let me use your PitchFX guru hat, because, you know, I tend to look at things more through a scouting lens, but, I mean, I saw a guy whose velocity was down 3 to 4 miles an hour from what I had seen in the minor leagues. I saw a guy that was hesitant to use his curveball, which I think is probably his best pitch, and he had really no fastball command. I mean, it was kind of a mess.
Yeah, well, people were definitely talking a lot about his fastball velocity. I wasn't that concerned. I mean, I can't give you the specific numbers for proprietary reasons. But what you saw in the majors is essentially what he had been throwing in the minors all season. He's a guy who hits 94, and he can reach back and touch 96. But, I mean, if you remember Steven Strasburg, he did this thing for ESPN in college where he was like, the guy who throws 103 miles an hour. Well, yeah, great. If it's a warm day and the gun is hot and he reaches back and throws everything, it's 103. But where he sits is 93, 94, 95. And he can live there very comfortably and dominate, but like you said, the command has to be there. And they were tinkering with his mechanics this year, and so when he was pitching in the majors, I didn't see a guy who was comfortable in his motion yet.
Agreed. Well said.
So that's kind of why everything felt like it was playing down. You know, I made a point of going to his first start, the one that was shortened by rain, and I felt like he looked pretty comfortable in that game. But he also only had to go through a lineup a couple times. And so by the end of the year, I think it was more a question of him getting comfortable again with the tweaks they were making to his motion, which it's kind of a big deal for a guy to move up a level just as he's making those adjustments. So I still am optimistic for what he's going to bring next year.
I would make the point too that this is really the first season that he's pitched a dramatic workload, you know, in his real any career, you know, any year, and maybe he was tired at the end of the year a little bit as well. Sometimes you can see that, you know, fatigue creep into fastball command.
I think it could definitely compound the issue of trying to get used to a new motion, where you're trying to get that muscle memory, that repetition, and part of it had to do with his legs, about how he was pushing off the rubber and things like that. And when you're a big body, it can take you some time to adjust to something like that.
So you're not – it doesn't sound like you're too concerned about Giolito. Certainly you sound like the low man concerned on the Giolito train.
Yeah, I think, you know, he has such a strong pedigree, and the stuff when it's good is still there. So it seems like a very plausible explanation that he just needs some more time to get used to the tinkering with his motion that they were doing with him mid-season. So, yes, I'm optimistic about him next year, and I think he will end up competing for a starting spot. Basically, I guess I'm going to repeat where I was a year ago, which is that, you know, in May when somebody goes down with an injury, he'll come in and be the fifth starter.
Yeah, I would have said June, but yeah, we're saying the same exact thing. So I think the biggest question for the pitching staff kind of walking into 2017 is the closer spot. You know, we see Mark Melancon could at least leave as a free agent. I don't think the closer is currently on the roster, although, you know, Sean Kelly had a fantastic year. Blake Treinen certainly took a step forward. Coda Glover looked good, you know, in his cameo, but what are your thoughts on where do you see them going with the closer role or spot?
Well, I guess payroll has to be the only reason they don't look at re-signing Melancon, right?
And the truth is Melancon might turn out to be the, I don't want to say bargain, but he might be the cheaper alternative in a market with Aroldis Chapman and Kenley Jansen available.
Right. That's the thing is you've got, Melancon in 2016 was the fifth highest paid closer, but Chapman was number one and Jansen was number four. So I think you're right. It's there is something to be said for the myth of the proven closer. But if you're a team that's trying to win the World Series and has a really good shot, yeah, why make it an adventure? I think if you can re-sign Melancon for another, you know, maybe 3 years, I think would even be safe. And he probably, yeah, he'll get less money than Chapman and probably Jansen. So it's not my money to spend, obviously. I would like to see him back.
But if you could, how about this? If I could have him sign 3 for $36 right now, would you make that deal?
I think 36 maybe would be a little steep. Chapman's 2016 salary was 11 and change. If his agent told me it's 336 or we're walking, maybe I could hold my nose and do it. I would want maybe save a little bit more, but I think especially, you know, 3 years is a reasonable length for a pitcher his age. I think he's 31.
Yeah, I mean, that, I'm thinking that we, you know, air quotes, hypothetically, we would be giving him a deal because I think he probably wants a fourth year. So I think he would be settling for a lesser contract at a higher annual average value is what I'm saying in my head, or at least trying to put on the table with this example.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably about right because he's still got bullets left in his arm, definitely, and it's hard to find someone who's been more consistent the last few years. I mean, his ERA has hung around too consistently. He did great in the DS, showed no signs of being rattled. I think if you know, rather than try to experiment with Blake Treinen, who's very promising, but you know, it's hard for me to imagine myself making it to age 35 if he's pitching in the ninth inning every day.
Yeah, I don't think you can. With his control issues and simply the movement on his pitch, I don't think you can ever make him your closer.
Right. It's like having do you remember what was his name? Christian Garcia?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Christian Garcia had just unbelievable stuff. And if everything, you know, he was this great closer in AAA, but the combination of his elbow and the fact that he just couldn't command his pitches more regularly meant he was never going to be that guy for the big league club. That's kind of how I feel a little bit about Treinen. His stuff is crazy good, but I mean, the Nats have had a couple guys like that. Henry Rodriguez was like that.
Yeah, very true. $1 million arm, 10-cent location. Anyways, yeah.
Yeah.
So before I move off the closer role, so you think what do you put the odds are that Melanson comes back?
I would have to say it's pretty good odds. I don't think the organization wants to have to go into the season, you know, with that kind of a question mark, especially with the memories of all of the closers they've had to go through recently, the mess with Papelbon. Melanson's the guy who gets the job done, and he doesn't have Papelbon's clubhouse issues, so I'm feeling good about them trying to work something out.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty good chance he returns to Washington. I think he's a pretty good fit, and I know Rizzo probably covets Chapman in that velocity, but I think that maybe the better fit is Melanson at kind of a 3-year deal for both sides.
Yeah, I think that would work out really well. I would be happy to see that.
So what else? I think that would, I mean, really and truly, I think most of the rest of the pitching staff is pretty straightforward. We mentioned, you know, Kelly and Treinen, you know, setting up. I think we'll probably see Solis and Perez on the left side, and I don't know, AJ Cole or some, you know, non-roster invite kind of rounding out the bullpen.
Yeah, that probably sounds about right. It's kind of painful now that Jeff Chinsky, we ended up getting him for a couple months and giving away Matt Schrock.
Yeah, I was a Schrock guy, or I am a Schrock guy, yeah.
Yeah, but I think, you know, hey, that's Rizzo being aggressive. And you gotta tip your cap. I think he saw an opportunity and really tried to make that happen. So
I wouldn't be upset if he came back either. I thought he did a nice job. I mean, it's tough to have three lefties in a bullpen these days, unless you really want to go to eight guys. But I wouldn't mind seeing him come back at the right deal either.
Yeah, although he might command more money than Rizzo would want to put out at this point. I mean, I remember, like, you know, he traded away Sean Burnett after having a really good couple of seasons just because the money was higher than the other available options. So.
And he is already $4 million committed to Oliver Perez next year, too. So, you know, is he going to want to spend, you know, $5-6 a year for maybe 2 years for Zepchinski, too? That's a good point.
Yeah, no, that you're right to mention the Perez. Yeah, that does probably add weight.
And Perez was decent if he just faced lefties. It was when they started to extend him or he faced some righties is when things really got out of whack.
Yeah, and that's just such an expensive role to have a guy do that. I mean, he's a former starting pitcher. That's not how you want to wind up with a loopy.
Yeah, true. Although on the flip side, I don't mind it if you just accept that, hey, his ERA is going to be elevated because there are 4 or 5 times a season he's going to own it. Because he can, you know, he has some experience, you know, just eating innings, so to speak.
That's true. Although it means he's your kind of, I mean, because, you know, Solis is obviously your best left-handed option right now. But so it just seems like a lot of money for your second lefty option.
Very true. Very true. So anything else that you want to mention or that we've overlooked heading into this offseason?
No, I think we gave the Nats a fair send-off, you know, talked about how there were some disappointments but still a lot of reasons to be excited.
Yeah, I would like to see them spend a little money on the bench if they could. I know we touched on that a little bit, you know, just early in the conversation, but I think that's one area where if they put $8 to $10 million extra into it, they could really see some nice benefits, considering their roster is so old and injury prone.
No, that's true. And I was sad at how poorly the Nate McLeod signing ended up being. I thought he was going to be like a great bench option for the outfield, but that ended up just completely vanishing with his injuries. Yeah, it's kind of they're going to have to be a little creative, search hard for maybe a veteran who's looking for a new shot.
And I'd be a big fan of not seeing Clint Robinson next season as well, but that's just me. So,
yeah, you got to salute his tenacity and having stuck it out all those years. But yeah, he's a very replaceable guy in the end. He doesn't really have a natural position. His bat is borderline. So,
I mean, he didn't have an extra base hit in the second half of the season until his pinch hit double in the playoffs. I mean, that just tells you everything you need to know about a first base corner bat.
Exactly, right.
And Zimmerman is a big question mark going into the season. I think his salary keeps him as your starting first baseman, but they need to have somebody behind him that's more capable.
No, that's definitely true. His body just is not going to let him apparently get through a season of regular productivity. So,
and maybe the answer is playing him 100 games next year. Even if he stays fully healthy, you know, basically playing him every two out of every three games and then platooning him with a left-handed bat, you know, to save him when they can.
Yeah, so I guess in essence you'd be upgrading Clint Robinson for a better version of that. Maybe, I don't know, who would be a good sort of, is there anybody that springs to mind who would be?
I've been thinking, although it's a trade, but John Jaso might be available with Pittsburgh. Not a ton of pop, but could fit at that left-handed, gets on base, plays first base, could also be your third catcher as well. I mean, $4 million next year. They have David Freese and Jung Ho Kang still there, and Josh Bell emerging. Just an idea, but somebody like that.
No, that's not a bad idea. And
we've traded with them before. It might make sense for them to clear $4 million. You know, just a thought.
That's not a bad idea. You should email Rizzo.
Yeah, I'm not sure he's taking my emails. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so, well, you've already taken a job title, so.
Yeah, he's a little upset about the name, so I don't know if he would take my email. But
right.
But in all seriousness, Dan, I just want to thank you so much. That was a lot of fun, just shooting the breeze and talking Nats baseball for a little while. How about a spot here for your plugs where people can find your work, where they can find you online, and frankly, anything you want to plug?
Sure. Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. If for some reason you want to hear more about what I have to say, my Twitter handle is SixToolPlayer, and I write occasionally for Baseball Prospectus, and go to brooksbaseball.net for the work that I do on PitchFX tagging.
And definitely one of my favorite Twitter handles, the SixToolPlayer is one of my favorites, so definitely he's a must-follow online, and definitely check out his work at the various places.
Cool, thank you so much.
Yeah, let's not go this whole offseason without catching a drink. That would be great in talking some baseball.
That is a very good idea, and I'm right by the park, so we can find someplace near the stadium.
Will I see you at the winter meetings?
I won't be around for the winter meetings, although I believe Harry was talking about coming to town, and he's obviously a hot ticket. So if he does come into town, I will let you know.
Excellent. That sounds great. All right, Dan. Well, I look forward to seeing you soon, and hopefully next year when we're talking about a World Series title.
You know what? From your mouth to God's ears.
Have a great one.
Okay, you too.
And that was episode 80 of the Nats GM Show with Dan Rozanson, SixToolPlayer on Twitter. Big Nationals fan, very, very sharp guy, and I'm glad and proud to call him a friend. So thank you to him for coming on. And I also want to thank No Halftime and the No Halftime app for sponsoring the show and the interview this week. If I could do a real quick plug for No Halftime and tell you a little bit more about it, let me do this right here. You're staring at your weekly fantasy opponent and thinking to yourself, I would love to challenge just one of his players, not his entire team. But your fantasy sports service doesn't allow you to. Now you can on the all-new No Halftime app. The No Halftime app allows you to create individual challenges using players or teams. For example, you can pit Bryce Harper versus Manny Machado, Mike Trout versus Miguel Cabrera, or Chris Davis versus Ichiro. Creating a challenge takes seconds, and accepting challenges is even easier. No Halftime challenges can be private or public and created for the MLB, NFL, NBA, NHL, PGA, and other sports. Join today and get started. And now you can also try No Halftime for free with $0 challenges. Visit NoHalftime.com for more information and to download the No Halftime app for your iPhone or Android device. Receive a bonus by entering in the promo code NATSGM at sign up. Receive a free t-shirt when you make a deposit. No Halftime, where the fantasy sports season never takes a break. Guys, I hope everybody's checking out No Halftime, particularly now in fantasy football season. I've really been enjoying it, doing a couple of head-to-head matchups with my buddies and talking some smack at the same time. So definitely check out No Halftime and the No Halftime app. With that, episode 80 is a wrap. Bye for now.